Session number 10314.
Riley Reel, 2.
Coding is quite a laborious business. I mean, quite obviously, you can't send messages in clear. Not only would they reveal the point of your transmission, but clearly give the enemy definitely the idea of what you were talking about, what you were doing. So everything had to go in code. The systems under which we've been trained were, first of all, the basic commercial Q code, which is the normal system of communication used in radio telecommunication work by ships, but sometimes by aircraft, where you use a standardized system of calling. For example, you send out a signal QRK IMI to inquire whether base is receiving you and at what strength, and base will reply on that QSA 1, 2, 3, 4, or 5 according to the strength of your signal. That's known as the international Q code. And there's a whole series of three-letter combinations of letter all commencing with Q, which indicate short messages, either send faster or send slower, or I missed that, send me a bit more or something. It's known as the international Q code. So that was what we used. Theoretically, I suppose you could say that an operator might be, if he's sending using the Q code, he might be a member of a Jebra team, or he might be a commercial operator of some description, might be a ship, might be anything. But the actual message itself had to be coded, and we used what a thing called the one-time letter pad, which was a pad onto which one wrote the messages. And there were the whole series of five-letter groups of words printed on these pads, quite meaningless groups of five. And you wrote the message underneath the groups of five letters. You then had what we call a silk square, which literally was printed on silk, whereby you took the two letters, the letter on the pad, and the letter of your message underneath it. You applied them to this silk square, which was a transposition thing, and you came up with a further letter, and that's the letter that you transmitted. The only way that you could break that code would be by having the confirmatory pad, which was obviously only one further copy, which was sitting back at one's base in England. So it was a foolproof code and incapable of being broken. But it took time to construct one message, because one had to write it all out on this one-time pad and to take the silk screen and to transpose it and get it into blocks of five and one thing or another. So a comparatively short message could take you half an hour or so to code. And clearly, the shorter the time you were on the air, the better, so that one encouraged one's colleagues to keep messages as short as possible. And also, if there was any German activity in the area, you obviously didn't transmit from the same place twice, because whilst we were operating in a country area and in an area in which we had a very detailed network of informers, so that we knew immediately any German troops came into the area, we had our system of intelligence that put us on the alert. But nevertheless, you still had to send messages, particularly if you were expecting a supply drop, that day or the following day. So you didn't transmit from the same place twice, because detective vans and the like would obviously have been onto you quite quickly. So the radio work was quite laborious, really, quite time-consuming and quite laborious. Again, with in organising a supply drop, there would be the messages would have to be sent. Most of the, we had certain dropping zones that we code-named, and we logged in London that a certain dropping zone with a certain map reference would be code-named Sally or something or other of that nature, so you can refer to that from then on. But nevertheless, if a drop was to be organised for 2 nights hence or something of that nature, the timing had to be very carefully organised. And it had to be also worked in, we usually worked it in at any rate, with a BBC message. The BBC did a marvellous job in this respect, in that one would set up the drop and have everything organised maybe 48 hours before, through the JED radio operator, sending his messages and receiving confirmation. But the actual final confirmation that that drop would take place at whatever time had been arranged, it might be midnight, it might be 2 o'clock in the morning, you would get from the BBC personal messages, which always came out from London with the 9 o'clock news, or the French overseas news. You get a whole series of message personnel, as he was to term, and your message, the code for your message might be, for example, the banker has given 1,000 francs to his son Emile. And that message will be in with a whole series of other jumble message of Mary sends love or all the rest of it. And if that message came at 9 o'clock and that, you knew your operation was on without any further message taking. Nothing. So that was another important part of the radio operator's job. He had to listen to other messages. He had to know what they meant, and he had to be able to interpret them for his colleague. So the Brittany operation was quite reasonably successful. I don't think we set the world on fire. We had about 200 men. At the time of D-Day, we blew railway lines, we blew bridges, we interfered with communication, we fought a little firefight, and generally made a nuisance of ourselves. And that went on until the breakout came from the bridgehead in whatever it was, 6 or 7 weeks after D-Day.
Presumably you didn't ever at any stage take a combat role.
I never fired a shot in anger on my first mission. And that was quite deliberately designed. Now, had we been under serious attack, I might have had to. I'd have had to. My colleagues were involved, but I was kept out of the fighting in my first operation. Second operation was rather different.
Did the Germans come close to you on the first operation? Did you have any narrow escapes?
Well, we saw a fair number of Germans, but frankly, in Brittany, the quality of the German defenders that we were mixing with was not of a particularly high order. On the coastline, yes, they were good. We were just a little bit inland, and there were a lot of line of communication troops and that sort of thing. Not really very high quality. I wouldn't say we had any. We didn't have to take on an armoured division or anything of any ridiculous nature in that respect.
What about the attitude of the people in Brittany? What did that seem to be towards the Allies and towards the Germans?
Well, they were what I would call certainly in the area we were in, tended to be good peasant stock. They had enough of the Germans, they had enough of them coming, taking their crops and their food and everything else, and they wanted rid of them. And they responded very enthusiastically to our presence. They supported their own local resistance group enthusiastically, and I have nothing but praise for them.
Did you come across Breton nationalism?
No, not at all. Not at all.
And you came across no hostility to the Allies?
No, not whatsoever. Certainly not in that part of Britain.
I gathered that you had nothing to do with this communist versus non-communist aspect of the resistance.
And fortunately, in our particular group, there was we didn't have any problems. I know some general teams had awful problems in other areas, but we had none. We had none at all. It wasn't a political war as far as these people were concerned. They just wanted to help get rid of the Germans.
How did your local French greet the news of D-Day? Did they go mad or what?
The average Breton isn't a, you know, he's not a particularly demonstrative type of person. Great relief, I think, would be and enthusiasm to want to play a part. There was certainly that great enthusiasm to want to help the Allies. Now, after having spent a fair amount of our early days in France, making sure that we could do as much damage as possible to the German lines of communication, when the breakout came from the bridgehead, when Patton broke out from the bridgehead and shot across Brittany, go down and swing round and go across France, there was a sudden change of role for the resistance fighters, and we were suddenly asked to try to protect the line of the Allied advance, assist in trying to secure bridges and hold road crossings and that sort of thing. So that the Allied advance was not interfered with. But this came right at the end of our sort of period. I'm talking now, I suppose, when early August. Probably early August or something like that, when the breakout came from Caen and the like. And really, it was from this point on that the Americans swept across Brittany. And our role, we ceased to have any real operational function from that point on. Once the Americans had gone through, there were odd mopping up to do and that sort of thing, little pockets of resistance. The Germans withdrew into points such as San Nazar, that was a long way away from where we were, and they went on fighting there for weeks and months later. But so far as the local resistance was concerned, it was, the job was over. And so we were overrun by the American army. We had the job of identifying ourselves, being taken back through various American sectors, and again we held certain documentation to prove who we were and what we were doing. Hence General Koenig's bit of paper again was of use in that direction. And we were back in London by the middle of August. We were still complete as a team. We'd been to France, we'd had one operation, and we were very keen to go back again. And so that we did. We went back to Milton Hall for a few days. We wrote our sit reps on situation that we report on the mission, and we were declared available for another operation. Things were very fluid in France, you'd appreciate it at that time. And we joined, there was a mission to be sent into central France. The mission was codenamed Étoile. And that's why I mentioned this fellow, Richard Broad, because Colonel Broad, who has written this particular book on his own experience called The Talent to Survive, Wartime Exploits of Richard Broad, was heading up a small mission which consisted of himself and a mission had been set up which was to be commanded by Colonel Broad, Richard Broad, with a Frenchman called Jerry Morel as his second in command. Now, Jerry Morel had been assistant to Colonel Maurice Buckmaster, who was head of the French section of the SOE, throughout the previous 18 months, 2 years. And in the party was also David Astor, Captain David Astor, the Astor family, a chap called Kilmartin, two French officers from the SAS, and our little Jedburgh team of Ken Bennett, Albert de Chernon, and myself. And the object was that this Jedburgh team would go with the mission. The mission was to have a fairly major role of coordinating resistance in the Besançon area, because there was a lot of resistance groups in the area that borders on the northwest frontier of Switzerland with France. The Haute-Soane, as it's called. The Americans were fighting their way up from the south, having landed in the Mediterranean. And everything was pointing towards the Germans being pushed back towards the Belfort Gap, and eventually a major battle did develop in Belfort, because that was the escape route between the Vosges Mountains and the Rhine. And so this mission was to... It was known that there were several thousand resistance fighters in that area, but they badly needed coordinating. And the mission with rankings of that nature of Richard Broad and Jerry Morel was felt that it would have the muscle and the ability to bring all these people into a sensible coordination. And we were to provide, I was to provide communications, and Ken Bennett and Albert de Chernon were to do a straightforward Jedburgh team operation with whatever we found on the ground in the way of supply of arms and ammunition and general staff work and whatnot. I can give you the exact date. We left by Liberator on the 5th of September from Thamesford. And again, we had a successful drop. We went into a well-known SOE agent, George Miller, who'd been organising a very successful Mackie operation near Besançon. And the drop went well. Reception was well organised. We had plenty of farm carts there to take the containers away and one thing and another. And we went off to a little town called Pontarlier. Well, it may be that after a successful trip in Brittany, we'd all got a bit slack and a bit cocky and one thing and another. Sadly, we literally ran into a German ambush, retreating German forces, and we were in three vehicles, and we got very badly shot up.
Do you think there was any breach of security?
No, I don't think so. No, I think this was just It was just the fact that we were moving in daylight instead of leaving things perhaps to moving at night. We were moving across open country, and we just ran into a German machine gun. And in the ensuing brouhaha, Ken Bennett and Alberta Sherman were both quite badly wounded. Captain Kilmartin got away with it, and David Astor was wounded. And I think this was Richard Broad tells in his book on which he includes the story of this particular mission. It's not really amusing. He tells the story of Albert de Schoenen, who after we managed to scramble after these vehicles and the two of us look left on the road, and we got into a ditch nearby. And poor old Albert, he took a cigarette and he was inhaling this cigarette when suddenly he noticed that literally smoke was pouring out of his chest. It sounds pretty gruesome, but he was in a pretty bad way. Anyway, got a long story short, we managed to... This was obviously a delaying action on the part of the Germans. We weren't surrounded by Germans. We managed to get away reasonably without too much difficulty. And Albert Schoenen and Ken Bennett and David Astor, they were taken away, and they were got away, and they were finished up in some American forward hospital, and eventually they were evacuated. But it was the end of the war, as far as I never saw them again during the war. And of course, that was my team. The two officers I was with and had gone with were out of action, and were indeed out of the war. And then I saw Bennett after the war, although I've lost touch with him since, and I saw Albert Schoenen quite often after the war, and indeed I still see him fairly regularly. He tends to organise the French end of the Jets, and we meet occasionally on reunions and one thing or another. But that was then. So, as a JEDBRA mission, we ceased to exist. But quite clearly, there was still a great need for communications as far as Richard Broad and Jerry Morrell were concerned. And I stayed with them and acted as their radio link. And we performed a very useful coordinating service to a very large number of French resistance troops. Indeed, we had the largest... We had a daylight drop of I think it was over 100 aircraft, 184 planes. Biggest daylight drop of the whole war, from which we armed over 3,000 Maquisards, 3,000 troops, which was quite an important point in the turning of the war in that part of France, because as I said, the Germans were coming up from the south, and this was very much a communist haven of French forces, but that didn't matter in the certainty. But they were very lacking in equipment and arms, and this very major daylight drop that we were able to organise quite quickly made them quite a useful and potent force in harassing the retreating Germans.
Was the communist character just incidental, or did it make any impact on you?
It didn't make any impact on me personally, and I don't think it made very much impact about as Broad and and morale were concerned. We were concerned in harassing the Germans and not playing politics.
How far afield did you range in the Besançon area?
Well, we went up to as far as the Swiss border, and then, I suppose within 30 or 40 miles of Belfort itself. Quite a wide range, quite a mountainous, difficult area, with some quite important little towns in the area. But again, particularly in view of my changed role, I didn't get very much involved in the actual physical fighting, other than once or twice when we came under attack, because the retreating Germans were, I wouldn't say they were particularly going out of their way to hunt down the local resistance, but if the local resistance was getting in their way, they were quite active in doing something about it. So one did come under, you know, one had to back up and move pretty quickly, and obviously there were a number of quite sharp firefights involved in that direction.
Did you see any German prisoners?
Yes, quite a lot.
How were they treated?
I would say, in the main, not unreasonably. In Brittany, they were usually paraded around a little bit and made made to look a bit like scapegoats and one thing or another. But I didn't see any evidence in Brittany of maltreatment of German prisoner of war at all. I did see the odd occasion of people, things getting a little bit out of hand in the Besançon area.
In what sense?
Oh, people, kangaroo courts, if you like, and that sort of thing.